Our first case is Aaron Young versus Brighton School District. Argument is set for a total of 44 minutes. It's a little confusing. So it's about 22 minutes per side. And the yellow light will go on in 7 minutes, 7.5 minutes. So we'll give you a little leeway. So both parties ready? Yes. A couple of housekeeping matters in addition to that. We do use iPads, and so we're not surfing and checking our emails, but we have all the briefs on the iPads and links to Westlaw and so forth. So I just thought I'd let you know that. And when you tell us, when you start your argument, please tell us who you are, who you represent. So, you ready?
May it please the court, counsel. A quick question. When you said it goes on in 7.5 minutes, you mean after 7.5 minutes?
No, at the end of 7.5 minutes.
When 7.5 is left?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. This case involves the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act, and Aaron Cole is, it's Aaron Cole Young versus Brighton School District. 9-year-old Cole Young.
Could you just tell us who you are and who you represent?
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Mark Fagnell, I represent Cole Young.
All right. Aaron Cole Young. Thank you.
I apologize. So 9-year-old Cole Young fell at the base of stairs that was determined by the trial court to be an area in a recreation area. That area was ill-maintained by the school district. He suffered a fractured skull, a mild traumatic brain injury, and excessive medical bills. He filed suit against the school district alleging, among other claims, that there was a waiver of immunity for what happened pursuant to 2410-106-1E. The trial court conducted a hearing pursuant to Trinity, known as a Trinity hearing, to establish subject matter jurisdiction. And the trial court, following that hearing, issued a rather lengthy 7-page order that was well-reasoned, well-thought-out, listed the facts and applied the facts to the law. In that order, the trial court determined that it indeed did have subject matter jurisdiction. And it went through this analysis as to whether this was a public facility, and it went through the prongs enumerated in subsection E of the 2410-106. So it's a well-reasoned opinion, and following the issuance of that opinion, the school district appealed, and the Court of Appeals reversed. In an unusual opinion, the Court of Appeals got it wrong on a couple fronts at least, and here's why. The Court of Appeals didn't address the trial court's determination that the area in which Cole Young fell was a public facility, and whether the waiver under 106.1E applied. Instead, without following the law, which is which states pursuant to Denmark v. State of Colorado, 954 Pacific 2nd, 624. It states that there's a highly deferential standard to a trial court when it makes a specific finding of fact. And the Court of Appeals or any court of review is not to disturb that finding unless the Court of Review makes a determination that there was that the findings of fact were clearly erroneous.
Mr. Tonelli, is that, do you have authority for, is it a de novo issue or question of fact to be found whether or not under the public way, facility waiver section, it's a dangerous condition.
Thank you for such an easy question. The of course, the finding of fact is not an issue for de novo review. As I mentioned, there's a highly deferential standard, and the standard of review is that the trial court had to be clearly erroneous in their finding of fact. So only for a question of law would there be a de novo review.
But whether it's a public facility is a question of law, correct?
Yes, but I agree with that, but there was a determination by the trial court that it was a public facility in a well-reasoned opinion.
Well, what was the basis of finding that it fit the statutory definition of a dangerous condition?
Well, the trial court went through this analysis.
Well, can you tell us? Tell us in your words.
In my words?
Sure.
Well, I thought the trial court's finding of fact, of course, but in my words, the analysis is whether this was a public facility, okay? So, is it public? Does it facilitate the public? Well, of course it does. And the trial courts split this into a two-prong analysis, whether it was public and whether it was a facility. In the Gallegos case, though, I think the analysis was really unnecessary because in the Gallegos case, City and County of Denver versus Gallegos at 916 Pacific 2nd 509, we have the court gave us a cue as to what a public facility is. And it states that there is a definition provided in Colorado revised statute, in albeit in title or in section 3760.126. And the Gallegos case says that we're at least going to use that definition as persuasive authority, or at least taking a cue as to a determination as to what a public facility is. And it says that a public facility means any facility operated by an instrument of government for the benefit of the public. And certainly, we know that an area of park of recreation is a public facility because it's inherent to the wording of the statute. They say any public facility, including an area of park or recreation. But what we know from the Gallegos case, and when we look at the actual statute that's in question, we know that a public facility can be land. Okay? And in the Gallegos case, it says, a public facility means a park, among other things, a park or recreation facility. And then it goes on to say, including a highway. It could be a highway. So a public facility can be a highway, at least according to the Gallegos case, citing this, the Colorado Water Preserver Board statutes.
Council, can I just stop you going through your definition of facility? Can you think of something that would not be a facility under your definition? I mean, you're adopting a rather broad definition of facility, correct?
Well, yes.
Okay.
But
what's the meaning of facility, and what would that just, how would you distinguish that from something else?
Well,
is it any government property? Start there.
Excellent. So the statute says, you know, we're going to create this, we're going to waive immunity for areas of park and recreation, okay? And we're gonna tell you not only the activities or the areas for which we're waiving immunity, then it takes it back and it says that we're going to grant immunity inside of these areas of park and recreation. So I think that your question and the definition is inherent to the language of the statute. It says we're gonna waive immunity for a public facility located in an area of park and recreation. And then the statute goes on and says, but we're not going to waive immunity in this area of park and recreation for a natural condition of unimproved property. So the General Assembly gave us, it's split up, the areas for which we are going to waive immunity and the areas for which we are going to grant immunity, which is why, in part, the Court of Appeals got it wrong, because they said, because there's very clear and unambiguous language in the statute. And while we're talking about it, you kind of took me off of place, but we'll stay with that issue. So there's this parceling out, if you will, the areas in an area of a public facility is a park area, park and recreation, and we're going to parse out the areas for which we waive immunity and the areas for which we grant immunity. And so if they, if the General Assembly, if the legislature grants immunity for natural conditions of unimproved property, because certainly inside an area of parks and recreation, you can have a picnic area, you could have a sandbox with a walkway down to another, you know, monkey bars, you know, where children play, right? And there can be this, certainly the walkway inside of that area is an improved,
condition. So I'll just restate your argument and just make sure I have it correct here. You're arguing that any improvement in a park or recreation area is a public facility. Anything that was improved, anything that isn't natural?
Not quite. I think that the public facility, that would be accurate in reading the statute. Public facility in an area of park or recreation. And then again, you know, we have grants, we grant immunity, we waive immunity, and then we carve out further exceptions to our grant immunity. Okay, and so there's a specific waiver of immunity for these areas that are unimproved, natural conditions that are unimproved. But going back to the Gallegos case and talking more broadly, what is a public facility? Because it says public facility located in, and there's this litany of park and recreation, swimming facility, right? So a public facility, going back to the definition of Gallegos, is it has to be maintained by a governmental entity, and it has to be used to facilitate the public. And so yes, that is a rather broad definition, but in the Denmark case, it says that, you know, when it talks about these three prongs of immunity, the waiver, the grant, and the exception, it says because the legislative intent is to allow redress to our citizens for governmental negligence, what we're going to do is, and this is the first time it was stated, was actually a departure in the Denmark case from the Gallegos case. This court says that we are going to now construe waivers broadly based on this overarching principle that the goal is to provide redress.
Can I ask you, how does the sidewalk fit within, or the walkway exception, how does that fit within your...
Can I just modify that question a tad bit?
Yes, sir.
How does the sidewalk fit into in a park as a public facility in a park or recreation area?
Okay, well, everyone refers to, I don't know how it got that moniker or handle, but people refer to 1D3 as the sidewalk provision.
Well, let's just deal with 1E, which is the definition of public facility, which says in. So we're talking about the sidewalk.
Right.
Okay, so tell me how you read that. How does it become a public facility?
Well,
it is
a statutory matter, but there's case law that says if the language is clear and unambiguous, the court need not resort to legislative history or the rules of statutory construction. So,
you mean we should look at case law as opposed to the wording of the statute? Is that what you're saying?
No, I think that we need to look to the wording of the statute.
Okay, so how does it fit into that statute? Because I think that's the critical question, which is what I think Justice Ivey asked.
Right, and I think to answer that question, we also need to look at 1D3, which is what the Court of Appeals said must apply. I think 1D3, when you look at the items for which the legislature said we're going to waive immunity, it's more of certain activities or conduct. And 1D3 is really, rather than the sidewalk provision, that's the snow and ice provision. It says, when are we going to waive immunity as to snow and ice? And it says specifically, we're going to waive immunity for an accumulation of snow and ice when these four factors exist. Number one, it's got to be on a public access. That access must lead to a public building, and that building needs to be open for business. This, what people commonly refer to as the sidewalk provision, allow me to take certain liberties, I think this is the snow and ice provision. Rather than the sidewalk.
And counsel, as I understand your argument, you're saying, look, we're not proceeding into what you call the sidewalk provision.
No, I call it snow and ice provision.
The snow and ice provision, because there is no snow and ice. You're not saying that the government waived immunity under that provision. You're saying it waived immunity under the public facility provision. You're saying this walkway where Cole fell constitutes a public facility, but this is inside of a recreation area, and I think that Chief Justice Bender's question, and perhaps also Justice Ide's question, is how on these facts does this walkway fit within a park and recreation area?
Because the Denmark...
But assuming for the moment that it is a public facility.
Right, because that was the finding of fact. And the Denmark case says that, you know, these, even though... the Denmark case was about an injury that occurred on an athletic field. And the public entity's argument was that, well, but this is an area that is designated for educational purposes. Okay, this is a specific area that is designated for educational purposes and not recreational activities.
Okay, so the trial court's finding, as I understood it, was we're going to call, even though the school has not formally designated this walkway as a play or a recreation area, as a practical matter, the children did in fact play in this area, and for that reason,
it was an area of recreation.
It was an area of recreation. So let me take that a step further. Are you suggesting that a rule should be adopted that any time an area is, as a practical matter, used for recreation, that is what makes it a recreation area? And the reason I ask that is, right out front of our courthouse, we used to have skateboarders take their skateboards up and down the railings. And the fact that it is used by skateboarders, would that deem then the front of the courthouse a recreation area?
Well, that's a hypothetical that I'm not sure was contemplated in Denmark.
But I'm asking about the effect of the rule that you'd be asking us
to. I believe there does need to be a logical nexus. There just can't be some absurd application that anywhere someone recreates, now we're going to designate that as an area of recreation. However, if there is a logical nexus, and in this case, the trial court found one, the Denmark case says that the designated area doesn't only have to be for educational purposes. In fact, if this is a typical and usual area of recreation, then it is an area, we're going to call that a recreation area as well. And so, I mean, that's the case law, that's not my position, that's what the case law says. And I do believe that there has to be some type of logical connection. Here, this was the playground of the school. It was connected to the playground. And beyond the school playground, there was this imaginary border. Beyond that, there were soccer fields. This was an area of recreation. This was a park. And the trial court found that in this adjacent area, the kids played there all the time. That was a factual determination based on the testimony taken at the Trinity here. And so, in answer to your question, no, I don't believe that, you know, someone, you know, jumps out of their car with softball gloves and starts catching softball in an area that's not typically used for an area of recreation. I don't think you can shoehorn that into this particular statute. There has to be some logic.
Thank you.
Could I follow up with just a couple of the formal considerations here? You keep going back to referring to this as a finding of fact. So I guess what you're saying is we have to show deference to the trial court's determination this was a recreation area, as long as it wasn't totally erroneous. Let me ask you a couple of questions regarding this. One, I don't think anybody's disputing the historical finding of fact, where this occurred, where the sidewalk was. So the question is, isn't it, what the rule is, as Justice Marquez was asking, what the rule is for a recreation area, how you would define it. And let me ask you one follow-up. You keep referring back to Denmark, but Denmark was a Court of Appeals case, wasn't it? And isn't that the very question we're asking here?
No.
Whether we want to adopt that rule?
With all due respect, I don't believe so. I believe that the question is, look, if we have a walkway, and the question is one of mutual exclusivity, okay? In other words, if we have a waiver under the statute that exists in this arena, and we have yet this other very narrow waiver for snow and ice, do we now need to take a clear waiver that's supported by the findings of fact and all logic and reason? Do we now need to reach into 1D3 and pull that particular provision of statute and say that, well, we're going to pull that provision of statute into 1E now? Because the Court of Appeals applied this mutual exclusivity rule that there cannot be a walkway that exists anywhere for which the legislature waived immunity, that the only time they're waiving immunity is pursuant to 1D3, this accumulation of snow and ice. That's what the Court of Appeals said.
Well, actually, I found the Court of Appeals a little hard to understand and why they were going off on the specific general sorted rule. But didn't they, just before that, just flatly say, we don't have to consider the provision you're talking about in 1E because this was not in a recreation area? So isn't the question whether it is in the recreation area?
Well, yeah, and I found that befuddling as well, and read the sentence. There's a particular sentence that I read over and over from the Court of Appeals decision, and frankly, it didn't make any sense to me either. And it says, even though the trial court made a factual finding that this was an area of recreation, there's a logical nexus, we're going to apply this, you know, this analysis, and we're going to use the, you know, case law, and we're going to make this determination, the Court of Appeals said, we don't have to consider that. Yet, in the same opinion, They said that this wasn't an area of recreation, and they didn't cite that the trial court made an erroneous finding of fact. It was clearly erroneous, and they didn't say that, you know, we need to be highly deferential to that particular finding. So it was rather confusing to me as well. But I want to get back to what I believe is the real issue here.
Mr. Magnoli, the time is kind of full up, so why don't you take a couple of sentences and sum up. Is that right?
There are specific statutory language that separates 1E and 1D3. It says any area. The notice provision is different between 1D3 and 1E. There's a specific notice provision applies. There's an exception in 1E that talks about whether it's actually 1.5C that talks about whether an area is paved or unpaved. Now, there is this specific statutory language that really describes areas of recreation, where we're going to waive immunity, where we're not. It talks about whether the area has to be paved or unpaved. And yet, the Court of Appeal says, we're just going to disregard on that. We're going to use this other provision. Again, one of mutual exclusivity. And the last thing I'll end with is that the goal is to harmonize the statute. And when interpreting two statutory sections, you must attempt to harmonize them and to give full effect to their purpose. And if possible, reconcile them as to uphold the validity of them each. And that's in the Norsby case. So why the Court of Appeals believe that they need to find this mutual exclusivity, and one needed to be to the exclusion of the other, is a mystery, because there's enough plain language of the statute to determine in 1D3, in 1E, that they consider all of these factors. There's no reason to reach into another part of the statute to extrapolate to try to, you know, go on this quest to find what the legislature meant when it's the language is clear. And I'll reserve a little bit of time.
Thank you. Unless there's
any questions.
Are there any other questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Bendit. Yeah, there is no more time. Go ahead. Sorry.
May it please the Court, Sue Stellar, Kaplan, and Ernest here on behalf of the Brighton 27J School District. Governors, I realize that you want to ask the Court to address the question of what's a public facility in the park or recreation area. In this case, however, you don't get to that issue unless you abandon several rules of statutory construction. Rules that words have been given their plain and ordinary meaning, that when the language of the statute is clear, it is to be enforced, and they're not to resort to strained or forced constructions of the statute, and that to set, if there is a tension between two statutory provisions, one general, one specific, then we use the specific provision, and most important, we interpret statutes based upon the language of the statute rather than the outcome that we seek to achieve. Let me back up and talk a little bit about the structure of the CGIA. The CGIA grants immunity. Immunity exists unless it's waived. It's universal unless it's waived. Those waivers are found in 2410-106, and they can be divided into two general classifications. The operational waivers, that is the waiver for the operation of things like an automobile, motor vehicle, correctional facility, public hospital, those really aren't on the table here today. And then there are the dangerous condition waivers. Now, it doesn't waive immunity for every dangerous condition. The CGIA waives immunity for dangerous conditions in specific locations. So if someone's going to take advantage of those waivers, they have to satisfy both the locational element of the waiver and what I refer to as the causal element of the waiver. For example, the CGIA deals with paved walking surfaces in two places. First, in 2410-106-1D, Roman 1, and that waives immunity for dangerous conditions of sidewalks that are located within the corporate boundaries of a municipality. So if a plaintiff is going to take advantage of that waiver, the plaintiff must demonstrate first the locational element that this is, in fact, a sidewalk. Sidewalk is a defined term in the Act. It's that area that's set aside for walking between the curb line or the traveled portion of the roadway and the adjacent property. If the walkway traverses away from the roadway and across the property, it's no longer a sidewalk, and there would be no waiver for that. Boulder Creek Bike Path follows a creek. It doesn't go alongside a road. It's not a sidewalk. The second locational requirement is, even if it is a sidewalk, it has to be located within the corporate boundaries of the municipality. If it's not located there, then it doesn't apply. There's no waiver of immunity. Finally, with respect to the causal element of that waiver, you go back to the definition of dangerous conditions set forth in the definitions, and there's the causal of the dangerous condition has to be because of an act or omission related to the construction or maintenance of that particular area. If the cause is due to a design flaw, there's no waiver of immunity. The second area where the CJRA addresses paved walking surfaces is 106-1D Roman 3. And that waives immunity for walkways that lead to public buildings that are open for business. Those are the locational elements of the waivers. The walkway has to terminate at a public building, and the public building has to be open for business. Cole can obviously fit those two locational elements of this waiver. The difficulty for Cole, of course, is the causal element. This waiver is narrower. It has to be from the accumulation of snow and ice. The dangerous condition has to be from the accumulation of snow and ice. The accident occurred in August. There was no snow. There was no ice.
Yeah, so that's a very interesting interpretation to me, that the legislature would have attended that rather than, you know, snowstorms are sudden. You know, you may be able to have notice that you need to clean it up and stop the dangerous condition, or you may not be able to. It seemed to me that snow and ice had to do with those kinds of physical facts about whether the entity was on notice sufficient that it had time to maintain it and remove it, so the dangerous condition would be removed. Can I get your comment about why that isn't a snow and ice provision as opposed to other times of the year that are addressed perhaps elsewhere in the statute?
Okay. You know, whether we label it sidewalk provision, walkway provision, snow and ice provision, we look, again, both at location and causal elements. The location element for this waiver in 106-1D Roman 3 is a walkway leading to a public building. That's the locational element of it. The causal element is the snow and ice requirement. You know, I think the way that the General Assembly looked at it, it looked at big walking surfaces, the walking surfaces all across Colorado. It wants our sidewalks to be free from dangerous conditions, and I think it deals with public buildings.
Yeah, but mud is not snow and ice, and you're basically saying the legislature didn't intend to have a waiver having to do with muddy conditions where someone could slip.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Oh, that's a reasonable interpretation of the legislature. This is just a seasonal kind of waiver.
That's absolutely consistent with the statutory language, Your Honor.
You're going to have to take me through that again. I don't quite understand why you say it just speaks for itself.
So the language of the waiver is that it has to be from accumulation of snow and ice, Your Honor. It's not for water. It's not for stones. It's snow and ice. That's the language that the statute uses.
Mudslides don't count.
Mudslides don't count.
Even if it can sit there for months.
Even if they would sit there for months. Your Honor, I think...
Could I jump in there just
sure.
A second? So the part I'm not getting, following on Justice Hobbs' question, though, why should we infer from that the legislature intended that problems with sidewalks or accidents on sidewalks should be exclusively covered by these sections that deal with sidewalks? What is there about the definition of public facility that would exclude from it a sidewalk as well?
Let's deal with walkway provision first, the D3 provision.
Okay.
That arises from principles of premises liability. If we are going to be inviting people onto our property, then we want to make sure that those conditions are safe. The conditions that the General Assembly wanted people to especially protect it from is dangerous conditions of snow and ice. As the same thing applies to walkway, it applies to this court. This court is not going to let a mudslide sit on its walkway for months simply because it can't be sued. For gaps.
See, I'm not phrasing my question right. And I understand why the legislature may have wanted to deal with that situation.
Sure.
But what is there about that waiver that indicates it's exclusive and that any other kind of dangerous condition that would apply to a sidewalk couldn't also be covered in some more general provision or more specific to a particular location, if that's the way you see it?
If we're going to use an omnibus waiver, then the General Assembly will never be able to legislate within that omnibus waiver. That is, it can't create a narrow waiver because the broader waiver would always apply.
Well, in a sense, as I said, you could see this as narrower since it's limited to a particular location, if that is the E section. could the legislature have intended to deal with snow and ice on sidewalks generally, but any other dangerous conditions of sidewalks as the sidewalks appear or are built in a recreation area?
The sidewalks, it does deal with that with sidewalks, and it specifically defines sidewalks as those areas that are between the travel portion of the roadway and the adjacent property.
Well, let's call them walkways.
The language in the statute uses the term sidewalk, and that's specifically defined by the statute. Well,
maybe just one last question then. So say again why you interpret that language to mean that a public facility can't be broad enough to include a walkway.
Your Honor, you look to, and I guess the provision of, if there are two statutory provisions, one specific, one general, you apply the specific provision. That's the foundational principle of statutory construction. There's no need to abandon that simply because this is a CGIA case.
Well, actually, even in the statute in Title II, when it talks about that, that's only if they can't be, if they can't both exist in harmony, isn't that right?
They don't exist in harmony if one waives immunity and the other doesn't waive immunity. That represents a legislative choice, Your Honor. The legislature has chosen to waive immunity for walkways leading to public buildings only in those circumstances, trusting that public officials will find other reasons to take care of other things that may impede the walkway into the facility.
Thank you.
Council, can I just...
Sure.
You seem to be relying on the general versus specific canon, but I'm wondering, does that mean that you were acknowledging, perhaps, that this could be a walkway in a park?
No, I'm not.
Located in a park or recreation area?
No, Your Honor, I'm not acknowledging that. And let me point out, look, if the shoe was on the other foot, if the causal elements were reversed, and I was trying to take advantage of this public facility, this public facility in a park or recreation area, telling you, look, this walkway where the kids lined up and where they weren't allowed to play, and that they used to access the building, that wasn't a walkway leading to a public building. That was actually a public facility located in a park or recreation area. I assume that you would take me to task for that, for avoiding the clear language of the statute, simply so that I could take advantage of the causal elements there. We have to look at the locational elements as well. If the statute applies, the statutory language applies, then the statute must be applied.
Okay, so then let me ask it a different way. Can you tell me why this walkway where the student fell is not a public facility located in any park or recreation area?
The question presented asks whether this walkway adjacent to a playground, something can't be in a park or facility if it's adjacent to it. In addition, you're going to be struggling today with what's the definition of a facility. Let me tell you what a facility is not. It's not a walkway leading to a public building because that is specifically set out in the statute.
But could it be a walkway just unto itself? I mean, thinking about a park and a walkway that cuts through the park, mm-hmm. that connects a couple of picnic facilities, why would that walkway in that context being located within a park or recreation facility not constitute a public facility itself? Is there a hole in the walkway?
Sure. Again, start with the presumption that immunity exists unless waived. What waiver are we going to be relying on?
It's the 1061E.
It's not a walkway leading to...
It's a public facility within a park or recreation area.
Let me use an example, Boulder Creek Bypass. Boulder Creek Bypass goes along the river, past an office park, past the university, past single family homes, and for about 100 yards, it goes alongside of Scott Carpenter Park. Are we saying that the Boulder Creek Bypass then, for those 100 yards, transforms from a public right-of-way to a public facility located in a park or recreation area and a different set of rules would apply?
Now, we actually don't have the case before us, so I think it'd be very interesting if we did. I'm having trouble with that. It seems to me logical that, you know, that's a public facility within a park.
And then at least the park, it would not be a public facility because it goes behind single family houses. It's the Boulder Creek Bypass.
Well, are you saying that then it's always, immunity is always waived for that circumstance?
My response would be it's a public right of way It's not a park that, it's not a public facility located in a public park for the 100 yards out of the 5 miles that it exists, simply because it happens to be going to a park at that period of time.
I guess I'd like to come back to these facts that sound by the trial court. You know, kids will be kids, right? Recreation area is anything outside the building, right? Where you play marbles, flip cars. I know those are things we did in the 50s. You know, if there was space, you do. You take advantage of it, right?
If, I mean, especially if it is, you're allowed to do
it's connected on a straight line to the playground, right?
You take advantage of it if you're allowed to do so, Your Honor.
So there's evidence here that there was a policing kind of function where the kids couldn't play in that area.
The question that was asked at the hearing was, do children sometimes play where they're not supposed to?
The answer was
yes. But let me tell you, when we have supervisors out there, they are not allowed to play there.
That's in the evidence. Doesn't make it. That's in the evidence as well.
Yes.
And
yes.
So what do we do with the trial court's finding? That regardless, this was deemed by the trial court to be a recreation area.
It's a question of what's really a finding of fact. And what the court said, and don't forget, let me talk a little bit about the procedural history of this, because we're focusing on this Trinity here. Understand, the court said 106.1d.3 is off limits as a result of a written motion to dismiss, because the court recognized, looking at the photos that were attached to that motion to dismiss, recognized that if it applied 1d.3, it would have to dismiss the case. So it took that issue off the table at that time. The only issue that was on the table at the Trinity hearing was whether or not this walkway leading to a public building was a public facility located in a park or recreation area. He took the walkway provision off the table as a matter of law. In addition, in the findings of fact, the way that the court responded, the way the court phrased the question is, the more difficult question is whether the school's walkways and access ways are also to be included in the definition of public facility. John, a walkway is a walkway is a finding of fact. Whether you're going to call a walkway a public facility, that's a conclusion of law. That's not a finding of fact.
And I'm talking about, let's work with that conclusion of law and assume that it's correct. For the time being, what do we do with the finding of fact that it was located within a recreational area because, as a matter of fact, children actually did play in that area?
Okay.
What deference do we owe to that?
I think it goes right to the question that you asked about skateboards. Does something become a recreational area simply because people use it for recreation over the objections of the people or over the instructions of the school staff that they are not to be doing that? Again, Your Honor, unless the walkways leading to this building are going to be considered to be a recreation area, then we have to look at the purposes and for which these things are designed, not what kids will do. Kids will play anywhere.
So is that the rule you would have us adopt, the purpose for which it was designed, or do we look at some sort of authorization for recreational activities?
You would look at the location. What is the location? It's a walkway. Are children allowed to play there? No, they're not allowed to play there. It's a walkway leading to the public building. It's the area that the children use to get inside the building. And so the finding really, he said, I'm not going to ignore the predilections of children. If that's going to be a finding of law, Your Honor, then again, skateboarders have at it. I lost my two front teeth to skateboarding.
What do you do with the rubric that was said that the waivers ought to be broadly construed and immunity narrowly construed, as the whole scheme is in derogation of common law?
That's an excellent question, Your Honor, and it's a question that this court has struggled with many times. In 83, in the Stevens decision, it included a footnote saying that the CJIA was in derogation of the common law and pointed to evidence. Nagy had said the same thing, pointing back to Stevens. Later in 1990, Bloomer, the court said exactly the opposite, that exceptions to immunity are in derogation of common law, and it cited back to an 1895 decision. The next year, the court reversed course, citing to Evans. The next year, the court reversed course again, citing to Plumer. This issue of whether it's in derogation of the common law has bounced back and forth like a tennis ball. I think what the court needs to do is to take a serious look at the history of this jurisprudence in Colorado from the Fisk decision in 1893 through Evans. The common law of Colorado was that there was sovereign immunity. Evans abrogated that. A plaintiff who was injured the day after Evans was decided still faced common law of sovereign immunity. A plaintiff who was injured a week after that still faced common law sovereign immunity. A month later, a year later, common law sovereign immunity went away June 30th, 1972, more than a year after the decision was issued, so that the General Assembly could step in and take its place. If we go to Evans and we look at the fundamental holding of Evans, it is the effect of this opinion and its two contemporaries is simply to undo what this court, the common law court, has done and leave the situation where it should have been at the beginning, or at least should be now, in the hands of the General Assembly. Your Honor, I think the core holding of Evans is that immunity issues are to be decided by the statutory law, not the common law. And to say that the CGIA is in derogation of this court's decision that the General Assembly should be making these decisions, that simply doesn't make sense. And it's led to a lot of confusion in the law. And I think it would be time for this court to say CGIA is what it is. It is a statute. In addition, I think that premise that statutes are in derogation of the common law exists not to reserve to the judiciary policymaking authority. That is, that legislative choices that are in derogation of judicial policy choices need to be narrowly construed to preserve the judiciary's policy choice. Instead, my recollection is that that provision exists so that we don't unnecessarily upset settled expectations. From 1893 through today, every plaintiff except the plaintiffs in the three cases in the Evans trilogy faced immunity. Those were the expectations. Your Honor, I understand sometimes we can look at the CGIA and we say that sometimes it leads to inequitable results. I don't think that's the appropriate language to use. Equity arises in the absence of the statute. When we have a statute, the equities are weighed through the democratic process. Now, we can see that there are instances where the CGIA elevates community interests over individual interests. But that is the decision that individuals working collectively through the democratic process can make, because those individuals recognize that they may be a footstep away from a slip and fall, and they also recognize that they are the beneficiaries of the public services provided. Your Honor, I have a minute left. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Well, we'll give you a couple more minutes. We gave it to Mr. Chandanelli. What are our questions? Any other questions?
I think you've given us an interesting analysis. The problem I have is that the reason for sovereign immunity has to do with the policy of protecting the public fisc. Private tortfeasors would be liable. So it's not clear to me that your construction is entirely correct regarding the decisions the court has made in the past. And the General Assembly also has within its ken protecting victims, obviously, with these waivers. Would you comment on that?
Sure, Your Honor.
Does your analysis give an adequate opportunity? This is immunity for claim, right? So it doesn't get to a trial, it doesn't get to a jury, you don't get to weigh the impact on the victims, the victim doesn't get compensation. Whereas if it was a private tortfeasor, they might.
You referred to the policy.
Yes, the policy, exactly. Well, we have to effectuate the policy of the General Assembly, its intent.
And that's set forth in 2410.102. First sentence of that states that the General Assembly recognizes that the common law doctrine of sovereign immunity is sometimes inequitable. Second sentence says that the General Assembly recognizes that this court abrogated that so that the General Assembly could fill the vacuum. The third sentence says the General Assembly recognizes that public services could be impeded by unlimited liability. The fourth sentence says the General Assembly recognizes that taxpayers would have to shoulder the burden of unlimited liability. The fifth sentence says people should not be deterred from public service simply because of unlimited liability. The next sentence says the General Assembly recognizes that the circumstances under which public subdivisions and the state can be sued should be set forth in one article. And the last sentence says roughly the same thing. There is not a statement in here saying we are adopting this to create remedies. That's the statement.
Well, but the rest of the statute creates remedies for exceptions. And that's what we're dealing with, is what did they intend by these exceptions, exception out of the general rule to address victim circumstances. I mean, how else could it be anything else than that?
Again, we would go back to the statement of policy. Statement of policy is pretty clear. We're trying to protect the state here. So those waivers are written very specifically with the locational elements and with the causal elements. And they need to be enforced as written by the General Assembly. No other questions? Thanks, Clerk, for your patience.
Thank you.
Your generosity. Thank you.
I want to thank both attorneys for your arguments, and the court will take a 10-minute recess before we hear the next case.